only touchy-feely sutta I could find, especially because the monk sitting next to me is called Venerable Abhaya. I thought, why not do the Abhaya Sutta, number 58 of the Majjhima Nikaya, to Prince Abhaya. Abhaya means fearless. It's a very short sutta, but it's got some interesting stuff in it. One, it sort of shows how, first of all, how people in the time of the Buddha would try and trick you, always like a fault-finding mind, trying to find some fault and to put down somebody else, which you can all relate to. Number two, it has a very, very famous little saying here about sometimes kindness can appear to others as a bit harsh, and I give the simile here of like a father putting their finger down the child's throat to take out a fishbone, and also about how to speak to one another, which is a very important thing. And also lastly, about just how the Buddha's wisdom, if you really know what you're talking about, then you can ask a person to ask you any question, and you'll be able to give a quick answer straight away, and a meaningful answer. It's because you know what you're talking about. And these are just a few of the things which is coming up in the simple but pithy Abhaya Rajakumara Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. Are you all ready? Here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay. So this is the Abhaya Rajakumara Sutta to Prince Abhaya, Prince Fearless. Thus I have heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel sanctuary. You can still go there these days. We're going to go there in a couple of months. Do you want to? The bamboo grove. So all of you going on the India pilgrimage, leaving the end of February, you'll be able to go to these places, and you remember, I know what happened there. In the bamboo grove, you had this story of Prince Rajakumara, Abhaya Rajakumara. In the squirrel sanctuary, then Prince Abhaya went to the Niganta Nataputta, who's the leader of the Jains, otherwise known as Mahavira. And after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side. Thereupon, the leader of the Jains, Niganta Nataputta, said to him, "Come, Prince, refute the recluse Gotama's doctrine," that's the Buddha, "and a good report of you will be spread to this effect. Prince Abhaya has refuted the doctrine of the recluse Gotama, who is so powerful and mighty." They're all trying to put each other down. In the time of the Buddha, it seemed that the Jains were very popular. If anything, from what many people suggested, even more powerful, more popular than the Buddha himself. Certainly they were his contemporary, and they were extremely popular. And so Niganta Nataputta wanted to try and refute the Buddha, but instead of doing it himself, he tried to get someone else to do the work for him. Have you got your book there, Liz? You didn't bring a book? Okay, somebody, very kind person. It's on the piece of paper. That's very kind of you. So Niganta Nataputta, the leader of the Jains, was trying to get him to refute the Buddha. "But how, venerable sir, shall I refute his doctrine? Come, Prince, go to the recluse Gotama and say, 'Venerable sir, would the Tathagata, the Buddha, utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others?' If the recluse Gotama, that's the Buddha, on being asked thus, answers, 'The Tathagata, Prince, would utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others,' then say to him, 'Then, venerable sir, what's the difference between you and an ordinary person? For an ordinary person also would utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others.' But if the recluse Gotama, on being asked thus, answers, 'The Tathagata, Prince, would not utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others,' then say to him, Then, Venerable Sir, why have you declared Devadatta? Devadatta is destined of Devadatta. Devadatta is destined for the states of deprivation. Devadatta is destined for hell. Devadatta will remain in hell for the eon. Devadatta is incorrigible. For those of you who know the story, that this times this particular sutta to the last year of the Buddha's life, when Devadatta tried to take over the leadership of the monastic Sangha, and with it the leadership of Buddhism, and in order to do that he tried to assassinate the Buddha after the Buddha refused to make him the leader of the Sangha. And those of you who know the story in more fullness, that Devadatta, he was a cousin of the Buddha, also ordained along with such other people as Ananda. They ordained together. And later on, Devadatta did actually manage to get some powerful states of mind, some jhanas and psychic powers. But when he got his psychic powers, he became quite proud and egotistical. And it's fascinating, as soon as he became egotistical, proud because of those powers, he lost those powers. It's a wonderful, almost like a safety catch or safety clause. If anyone does develop deep meditation and gets any psychic powers, if you misuse those and start breaking your precepts, you lose those powers and those deep meditations almost immediately. Simply because those psychic powers, they are based on meditation, which itself is based on a pure mind. And if that mind isn't pure enough, that meditation falls apart. As you all know, one of the favorite stories, I'm just adding these as a filler for this short sutta, that in one of the commentaries there was a monk many, many years even before the Buddha who got into a deep state of meditation and could actually learn how to levitate. And he just lived in the forest, in the jungles, and he would just live such a simple, peaceful life. And every morning he'd go for his morning exercise, but unlike ordinary people, it was up in the air rather than around the river. So he went for a jog in the air. And he enjoyed himself very much. He lived a very peaceful life. But the trouble is that when he levitated like that, sooner or later, a villager gathering wood in the forest saw him. And when they saw this monk levitating through the air, they told their friends. And soon that monk became quite famous. And his ability to levitate also became so well known, it reached the palace. And when the king actually heard, yes, actually there is a monk who can levitate, he decided to go and check out this monk. He'd never seen anyone levitate before. For example, if I told you that some monk in, say, Serpentine Monastery could levitate, you'd probably all go down with your video cameras to check him out. So this is what the king did. He went into the forest with some of his soldiers, and he saw, yes, this monk actually could levitate. And so he thought, wow, this is a really special monk. Not only has he got great powers, he must also be very wise as well. And so he invited the monk to come and stay in the palace, so he could advise him on his duties, and also so that the monk, so the king could give this monk alms food and gain a lot of merit by giving food to a holy monk. So the hermit refused. He said, I don't want to live in a palace. I'm quite happy here in my forest. But kings being kings, especially with a few soldiers around him, he gave the hermit, in what was known 25 years ago, an offer he couldn't refuse. So he had to go. So he packed up his stuff very quickly, and he got carted off into the palace. The king was very kind. He made him a nice little forest inside the palace grounds with a little hut. And he said, you can stay here for 7 days of the week. Just once a week on the moon nights, I will come and ask you questions on Dhamma. And it wasn't such a bad arrangement. It seemed to be okay at the time. You know, he could still have his privacy, still live in the forest, although it was in the middle of the palace grounds, and just enjoy himself. And the king was happy, the hermit was happy for a while. But one day, when the monk was on his morning jog up in the air, instead of one of the king's servants bringing him his food, the king sent one of his princesses, this really gorgeous young princess. And as the monk was sort of coming back from his morning exercise, he was still up in the air when he saw this gorgeous princess. And he had one moment, just a moment of lust in his mind. And at that, he lost his psychic power to fly. Unfortunately, he lost it while he was still quite high up. So the inevitable happened. He came crashing down to the ground, and it really hurt. And he realized from that, that if you're going to practice such things, it's much better to do it in a forest, away from beautiful princesses, than in the palace of a king. So immediately, he sort of packed up his stuff, And he had to walk back to where the forest was. And it took him about 3 years to get his psychic powers back again and be able to fly. And the moral of that story is that if you even have one moment of a bad mind state, you lose those powers, as did Devadatta. Okay, so that's a bit of feeling. That's any comments on that question? On that? Okay, very good. So next question. So look, out of compassion, if you ever see like a monk flying, and you're a pretty girl, please sort of hide your head or whatever, just hide behind a bush, out of compassion for that monk. Or if you're sort of a hunky man, and one of the sisters at Kichiganup is flying through the air, please be careful. We don't injure them. Anyway, so this is Devadatta. He lost his powers. And so the Buddha actually said, because of his attempts to try and kill the Buddha and because of his trying to spit the Sangha, that that was a karmic result. He would go to hell for a while. And he said, because you said this of him, then Venerable Sir, why have you declared of Devadatta? Devadatta is destined for the states of deprivation. Devadatta is destined for hell. Devadatta will remain in hell for the eon. Devadatta is incorrigible. Devadatta was angry and dissatisfied with that speech of yours. When the recluse Gotama is posed this two-horned question by you, he will not be able either to gulp it down or to throw it up. In other words, he'll choke on it. If an iron spike was stuck in a man's throat, he would not be able to either gulp it down or throw it up. So too, Prince, when the recluse Gotama is posed this two-horned question by you, he will not be able either to gulp it down or to throw it up. So this was just a way to try and get the Buddha to ask him a question which he could not answer. It was amazing in those days you try and overthrow a person's reputation just by a little bit of debate. The skills of debate were very common in those days, and when a person was going to try and refute somebody else's doctrine, they would try and just do it by debate, by clever speech, and usually they would invite a large crowd of people to come along to see. And there's many stories, suttas, in the Pali canon of people trying to debate with the Buddha, and this was one of them. So, in other words, does the Buddha approve of what they thought was bad speech? Speech which is disagreeable to others. And the point was that the Buddha had said something disagreeable to Devadatta. So Pinsabaya replied, "Yes, Venerable Sir." Then he rose from his seat and after paying homage to the leader of the Jains, Niganta Nataputta, keeping him on his right, he left and went to see the Blessed One. After paying homage to the Blessed One, he sat down at one side, looked at the sun and thought, "It's too late today to refute the Blessed One's doctrine. I shall refute the Blessed One's doctrine in my own house tomorrow." Then he said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One with three others consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me." The Blessed One consented in silence. He's obviously, when it says that it's too late, he probably was a bit scared. So he wanted time to think it over a bit more. So then, knowing that the Blessed One had consented, Prince Abhaya rose from his seat and after paying homage to him, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then when the night had ended, it being morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to Prince Abhaya's house and sat down on the seat made ready. There was many other cases of people trying to bring harm to the Buddha. There was one time, this man, he invited the Buddha and many monks to a meal in his house. And what he did the day before, he got his workers to dig a big trench in his courtyard. And he filled the trench up with all sorts of filth, with feces and cow shit and all sorts of the most horrendous stuff. This whole pit of disgusting stuff. And then he put some twigs across that and then some straw and then he laid out some mats with the idea that he'd invite the Buddha and the Sangha to sit down on there, and when they sat down, they would fall through. And according to the story, if I remember correctly, when the Buddha came there, he refused to go in. But I think then, I must admit, the Buddhist suttas are a bit harsh on the Jains. So this guy couldn't get the Buddha to go in, so he invited the Jains in, and they came and sat down. You know what ended up? Anyway, next, coming back. So, he invited him to a meal in his house. And then, Then, with his own hands, Prince Abhaya served and satisfied the Blessed One with various kinds of good food. When the Blessed One had eaten and withdrawn his hand from the bowl, Prince Abhaya took a low seat, sat down at one side, and said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, would a Tathagata, a Buddha, utter such speech as would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others?" And the Buddha answered straight away, "There is no one-sided answer to that, Prince." In other words, he didn't take the bait. The Buddha knew that you can't actually, that's not a question which has a yes-no answer to it. "Why?" And then Prince Abhaya replied at once, "Then, Venerable Sirs, the Jains have lost in this." "Why do you say this, Prince?" "Then, Venerable Sir, the Digantas have lost in this." Prince Abhaya then reported to the Blessed One his entire conversation with Niganta Nataputta. And then here the Buddha gives this wonderful simile. "Now, on that occasion, a young tender infant was lying prone on Prince Abhaya's lap." Remember, this was at a house dana. "Then the Blessed One said to Prince Abhaya, 'What do you think, Prince? If while you or your nurse were not attending to him, the child were to put a stick or a pebble in his mouth, what would you do to him?' 'Venerable Sir, I would take it out. If I could not take it out at once, I would take his head in my left hand, and crooking a finger with my right hand, I would take it out, even if it meant drawing blood. Why is that? Because I have compassion for the child.' So too, Prince, such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter." In other words, it is untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, and unwelcome. It doesn't say such things. Number two, such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is also unwelcome and disagreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter also. So it's true, but it's unbeneficial, so it's not much point saying it. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true, correct, and beneficial, but which is unwelcome and disagreeable to others, the Tathagata knows the time to use such speech. So it's true, but it is beneficial, but disagreeable to others. You've got to know the right time and place. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, but is welcome and agreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true and correct, but unbeneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable to others, such speech the Tathagata does not utter. Such speech as the Tathagata knows to be true, correct, and beneficial, and which is welcome and agreeable to others, the Tathagata knows the time to use such speech. Why is that? Because the Tathagata has compassion for beings. In other words, of all those combinations, if it is untrue, the Buddha would never utter it. If it is unbeneficial, the Buddha would not utter it. But if it is true and beneficial, then whether it's disagreeable or not disagreeable, the Buddha would know the right time and place to speak it. And why is that? Because the Tathagata has compassion for beings. So when you talk to your partner in life, if what you're about to say is untrue and incorrect, do not utter it. Doesn't matter whether it's agreeable or disagreeable to them. If it's untrue and incorrect, do not utter it. If it is unbeneficial, whether it's true and correct or not, whether it's agreeable or not, one does not utter it if it's not beneficial. But if it's beneficial and it is true and correct, whether it's disagreeable or agreeable, if it's what they want to hear or what they don't want to hear, you've got to know the right time and place to say it. And even if it's disagreeable, if you know the right time and place, then it's a good thing to say. Which is why you've heard me say the simile before. In married life, if there's something which is true and correct and very beneficial, but will be disagreeable to your partner, then what you should do is to take them out to dinner, to a really great restaurant. where they have lots and lots of courses. And when you come to the final course, then you can hit them with the true, correct, and beneficial thing, which they may find disagreeable, because at the end of a lovely dinner, that is the right time and place. They'll listen to anything at that time. The point is, you don't hit them with these things when they're tired, when they've just come back from work, when they are not really open to hearing these things. So it's always the right time and place. And beneficial that sometimes, as the Buddha was saying over here, that if there was a, what's it called, the stick or a pebble, I think it was in the commentaries they say, like a fishbone, was actually stuck in somebody's throat, it's obviously out of compassion beneficial to pull that out, because this might hurt them. So compassion does not always mean just doing what is agreeable to others. Sometimes it's disagreeable to actually to pull that fishbone or that twig out. But it has to be done. So you have to choose the right time and the right place to do these things. And that is really the trick. There's so many problems come up in families or in monasteries or in nations because they choose the wrong time and the wrong place to say these things. And this is the meaning of what the Buddha's saying over here. And so compassion doesn't always mean like doing what's agreeable. Venerable Sir, continues Prince Abhaya, Venerable Sirs, when learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders and learned recluses, after formulating a question, then go to the Blessed One and pose it, has there already been in the Blessed One's mind the thought, if they come to ask me, and ask me thus, I shall answer thus, or does the answer occur to the Tathagata on the spot? So now how come people are so wise? They can give an answer straight away without any prompting, without any thinking beforehand. Venerable Sir, says Prince Abhaya. The Buddha back to Prince Abhaya. As to that, Prince, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you choose. What do you think, Prince? Are you skilled in the parts of a chariot? Yes, Venerable Sir, I am. What do you think, Prince? When people come to you and ask, what is the name of this part of the chariot? Has there already been in your mind the thought, if they come to me and ask me thus, I shall answer them thus, or does that answer occur to you on the spot? Venerable Sir, replied Prince Abhaya, I am well known as a charioteer, skilled in the parts of a chariot. He's what we'd now call a petrol head, only in those days they didn't have petrol, they just had chariots. Venerable Sir, I am well known as a charioteer, skilled in the parts of a chariot. All the parts of a chariot are well known to me. That answer would occur to me on the spot. So too, Prince, when learned nobles, learned Brahmins, learned householders and learned recluses, after formulating a question, come to the Tathagata, the Buddha, and pose it, the answer occurs to the Buddha on the spot. Why is that? That element of things has been fully penetrated by the Tathagata, through the penetration of which the answer occurs to the Tathagata on the spot. So all these teachings which people ask, because the Buddha had penetrated that to the very limit, to the max, therefore he could answer on the spot. Which is another way where you can really find out whether the person understands what they're talking about. If you ask them a question, they don't need to go into the books, they don't need to ask somebody else. If they really know what they're talking about, they should give an answer straight away. And as I've often mentioned, the answer should be something which makes sense. It should be not some sort of answer which is just so convoluted that you don't even understand sort of the meaning of what the person has said. So I know that sometimes people think that the more mystical your sentence, then the more wise you are. So if you say something which nobody understands, oh, it must be profound. So, real knowledge is something from here, like explaining what a chariot is and how it works. If you're an expert on those things, you'll be able to explain it straight away and in words which people can understand. And the reason is, the Buddha says, because the Tathagata, through the full penetration of those elements, in other words, has fully understood it. So, any comments about this so far? Before we finish off, if there's no questions, this is going to be the fastest Dhamma class in the history. Thank you for saving me. Ah, it's just, well, these things happen sometimes. No, well, why do monks levitate? It's if a monk levitates, it's literally because they've got no control over it. It just happens. Remember that all of the teachings of meditation I've been given over the years about letting go of control, not doing things. And this is what happens. So they don't do it on purpose. No, a lot of times it's just these things. There's once when the Buddha was, I think it's in the Sangita somewhere, he was saying that at times that he was just, because of the deep meditation, and because of the power of the mind, and the bliss especially, he said if his body was so light, he felt just so light with the bliss, that sort of, he said that just like a little, it felt like a bit of cotton, that just a little bit of wind would have blown him away. What's interesting there, what he was saying, is actually what it feels like before levitation. Just so much happiness and so much bliss, the body feels light. And one can understand that we have even expressions in English that, you know, when you're really sort of loaded down with depression, you've got a very, very heavy sort of heart. And you can understand that the lightheartedness of joy and bliss is like not just a metaphor, but is something which is even deeper than a metaphor. It wasn't just the Buddhists. I mean, there was a very well attested St. Teresa of Avila, I think it was, who would always, not always, but every now and again during the services in her church, would levitate. And the other nuns had to, as soon as they saw her going up, they would grab hold of her feet and pull her down again. Because she was always doing that. But completely involuntary, it just happened, that's all. Although that later on some monks would sometimes use that power for other reasons. But even though that such things happened, the Buddha always said, just keep it quiet and don't sort of show off any psychic powers. And the classic story of that was when, in Rajagaha as well, this is close by to the bamboo grove, this was actually in the monks' rules of discipline, the Vinaya. There was a very wealthy man, and he wanted to see somebody levitate, as of course most people would. You know, if an abhya could levitate, he'd say, come on, show us, just once. We won't tell anybody, you say, just once, because it'd be nice to see somebody levitate, wouldn't it? So anyway, this very wealthy man said, okay, it'd be great to see someone levitate for change. And all these religions, not just Buddhist religions, other religions there at the time, so he managed to erect, on top of a bamboo pole, this very, very expensive and very costly sandalwood alms bowl. So that's something which all the monks needed, an alms bowl, but this was made out of sandalwood, incredibly well designed and very expensive. And he went around saying, if there are anybody, any monks, nuns of any particular sect who can levitate, let them take this bowl. I give this bowl to any recluse, monk or nun, who can levitate. If they can reach it, they can take it. So it was like a test. And no one could actually take it for a few days. And then it was actually Mahamoggallana and Pindola Bharadwaja. They were walking on arms round. And then it was actually Pindola said to Mahamoggallana, Mahamoggallana, you've got great psychic powers, why didn't you go and take that bowl, actually to increase the faith of the lay people? He said, no, well, you can levitate as well, you take it. So Pindola decided to take that bowl. So he rose up into the air and took hold of the bowl. But his big mistake was this, that having taken the bowl, and this actually shows the origin of a custom we take for granted in the West, especially after sports matches, but it has its origin in Buddhism 2,500 years ago in Rajagaha, which is a fascinating thing to know this. This was the earliest record of what we now call three laps of honour. Because having taken that bowl, still up in the air, he flew around Rajagaha three times. And of course, everybody saw him. And that was his big mistake. Because as soon as they saw this monk circling Rajagaha three times in the air with this wooden bowl, which everybody knew about, then they all left their jobs, whatever they were doing, and they went to the monastery to pay their respects to this great monk who they saw actually levitating. And when they all started charging in the monastery, the Buddha was there meditating and said, "What's this great noise, like fishermen hauling in their catch? What's going on? Why are all these people coming to this monastery?" And when he said, "It's because Pindola Bhavadwaja had risen into the air and had got this great prize, this sandalwood bowl, which was on the top of a bamboo pole. No other way he can get it except by levitating." And then the Buddha told Bhavadwaja, "Come over here." And he told Pindola off. And he used this invective, which was quite gross, but I have to say it because this is what he said. He said, "Pindola Bhavadwaja, you just exhibited a psychic power just for the sake of a measly wooden bowl." He said, "That's just like a prostitute shows off her private parts just for a few dollars." And that really hurt. He said, "That's what you've done." And he said, "Take that bowl, smash it up." And he made a rule that monks aren't allowed to have wooden bowls from that time on. And also, you shouldn't exhibit a psychic power just for the sake of material gain. And that's where we got that rule from, that we have to hide all our psychic powers. So that's the story of why the Buddha said, if you can do these things, keep it quiet. That make sense? Otherwise, if one of our monks or nuns could levitate, we wouldn't hear the end of it from the Australian Olympic Council. They make us go to Athens to get a gold medal. No, they already had Athens. What's the next one? Beijing. They make you go to Beijing to get the prizes in the high jump and the pole vault as well. You could probably do both. Double gold. You wouldn't need a pole. You just carry it in your arm and just run up and just levitate. Okay. So that's why we don't do those things. The other thing I was saying in Singapore, if you actually could show that you could read people's minds, that'd be even worse. Because the CIA, they'd probably employ you. They wouldn't need interrogators anymore. They'd take you to Abu Ghraib. They'd take you to Guantanamo Bay. You'd find out straight away who the terrorist or not the terrorist. Perth Airport would probably employ you at the gate to check people to see whether they're going to blow up aircraft. You just read their minds. Yeah, he's got bombs. No, he hasn't. He hasn't. Be much cheaper than these electronic surveillance things. So that's why we don't tell anybody, otherwise you'll hear the end of it. Hey, how do you answer that question anyway? I don't know. Why they're playing around. Oh yeah, that monk, yeah. It's an old story. But the fascinating, I know that some people are very afraid of like psychic powers and things like black magic. But the point is that if you have psychic powers, then if you lose your virtue, you lose your powers straight away. So and you've heard me say it before, when you practice your meditation, that you have to go to get into the deep jhanas where you get those powers, you get them very strongly, you have to actually go through the nimitta stage. And I mentioned before that nimitta, which you see in the mind, when we see as your mind, when you get very still and the five senses start to drop away, that is a reflection of your mind. And if you're a pure-hearted person, that is very powerful, that is very pure. But if you have been misbehaving, in other words, you haven't been keeping your precepts, you haven't been selfless, you've been proud, you've been even angry, then that nimitta will not be pure enough to take you into jhanas. It's very clear to see how that works. So if you can't go into those jhanas, your psychic powers just fade away. That cut clear. Okay. Any other question? Yeah. Okay, the only really way you can find out and know for sure that what you're saying is beneficial, that you know the difference between what's beneficial and not, is to be enlightened. So the thing is, you should shut up until you become enlightened. Well, it does actually say, if you read it more clearly, that say, as long as it's true and correct, and, okay, yeah, it has to be beneficial, that's right, if it's unbeneficial. So, be very careful. That's why any of those of you who've been on my 9-day retreats, I talk about noble silence, being you can speak to others, but before you speak, you should contemplate, is what I'm about to say really important, really beneficial, basically. And then, if you answer yes, you've got to think again. Is it really, really beneficial? And if you pass that second test, you still have to think a third time. Is it really, really, really beneficial? And only then you can actually speak, if it passes the three tests. Really beneficial, really, really beneficial, and really, really, really beneficial. And usually by that time the person has walked away, so you can't talk to them anyway. So that's my way of keeping noble silence. So the point is that a lot of times the people don't even consider when they open their mouth, is this going to be beneficial or not? It just pours out, just like a broken tap or broken water pipe. And it gets all sorts of muck, gets into the pipe then. So don't be like a broken water pipe. Sort of restrain yourself and just think, you know, is what I'm going to say really beneficial? And is it at the right time and the right place, for goodness sake? And then, if you do it that, you can always make sure you never upset people. How many of you have opened your mouth at the wrong time and you've regretted it? Oh, I wish I hadn't said that. Yeah. But do you know that story about there is a Buddhist ceremony that if you said something very, very bad, you can actually get rid of all the bad karma of bad speech? It's a chicken plucking ceremony. Have I told that here recently? I was telling it in Singapore a lot. It's a chicken plucking ceremony. It came about many, many years ago. I've got to fill in time because it's a very short suit of today. A long time ago, there was this man who'd said something really awful to his wife. And he was so upset about it. It was almost like, you know, a grounds for divorce. So he wished he hadn't said that terrible thing. So he went to his favorite monk. He said, "Oh, venerable sir, you wouldn't believe what I just told my wife. Is there anything I can do about it? You know, can you help me sort of, as, you know, get rid of all that bad karma for saying something bad? What can I do to overcome that bad karma?" And he said, "There's only one ceremony we can do in Buddhism. And if you can perform this ceremony according to the standard ritual, then you'll be okay." He said, "Great, I'll do it." He said, "It's difficult, doesn't matter how difficult it is," he said, "I will do it because I'm in big trouble with my wife." He said, "Okay, what I'll need is a chicken. So there's enough time now, the market's still open, go to the market, get a dead chicken, and on the way home, can you just pluck it for me? Take out all the feathers and throw them away, because I want to use the already plucked chicken for the ceremony." So the fellow said, "Great, I'll do that. Are you sure it will work?" He said, "If you follow the instructions, it will work." "Now what are you supposed to do?" He said, "Go to the market, buy a chicken, take out the feathers, and bring it to you already plucked." "Good." So he went to the market, he bought this chicken, and on the way back from the market to the temple, he took out all the feathers, threw them away, and by the time he got to the temple, there you were, he had a nice plucked chicken. "Now," I said, "is that going to overcome my karma?" He said, "No, not yet. There's another part to the ceremony. You've got to come tomorrow morning. First thing, and we'll do the second part of the ceremony. In the meantime, I'll put the chicken in the freezer." So he put the chicken in the freezer. In the morning, the man came up bright and early. His wife wasn't speaking to him at all because of what he said. But he thought, "Well, it won't last a little bit longer. It won't last very much longer. Soon the ceremony will be completed, and then I'll be okay." So he went to the monk, and the monk said, "Okay, now you can do part B of the ceremony. And this is the most important." He got the chicken out of the freezer and handed it back to the man. He said, "Now I want you to retrace your steps back to the market. Go back exactly the same way you came yesterday and pick up all those feathers and put them back exactly where you took them out from the chicken." He said, "I can't do that." He said, "I probably won't even find all the feathers, let alone be able to stick them back in again where they were before." And he said, "Well, if you can't do that, we can't fulfill the ceremony." He said, "It's just like you can't, once you take a feather out of a chicken, you can't put it back again." He said, "No more. When words come out of your mouth, you can't catch them. You don't know where they've gone. Like the feathers, they're probably all blown away again. Once they come out of your mouth, you can't catch them and put them back in again. Once out, they're gone." And he got the meaning of the ceremony. It's not that you can actually catch words and put them back in again. You have to make sure you don't take them out in the first place. So the meaning of the ceremony, be careful what comes out of your mouth. Once out, it's gone forever. That's a chicken plucking ceremony. Okay. So be careful. Make sure you know the right time and the right place to speak to people. And obviously, the right time and the right place is to check their state of mind. Especially if you live with another person, it's not that hard. You know their moods. You can usually read them pretty well. Sometimes it's just because we don't really check out to see whether the person we want to say something to is really open and ready to being told, especially if it is something disagreeable. If it's something agreeable, you can probably tell them at any time. But disagreeable stuff, you have to be very careful. So thank you for that question. We managed to waste another 5 minutes. Any other question on this very profound and deep sutta, which I thought it was more profound than it was, but never mind. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, we remember those because we teach them a lot in the monastery. Because in a community, there'll always be people criticizing each other or wanting to. And now the first thing is actually to consider, is what I'm about to criticize someone else for, am I doing the same or something similar myself? Because you know what happens when someone, you know, you criticize somebody, you tell someone off and say, well, what about you? I can tell a few things about you while I'm at it. So the point is that if you are misbehaving, or if you're being lazy, if you're being sloppy, or whatever, then it's a waste of time criticizing others. It's the old, even in the Christian Bible, they say, take out the plank of your own eye before you take out a splinter of somebody else's. Just don't be a hypocrite. And that's really important, because if you go around criticizing others and you're not a good person yourself, you have got no authority. And that's really important if those people were children. Sometimes we try and criticize our children, but then they look at us and think, well, what's mum and dad doing? I remember as a school teacher, there was to be a school rule about no smoking. But the children would rightly complain. Every time they had some business in the staff room, they'd knock on the staff room door, and as soon as it was opened, the billows of smoke would come out. Because all the teachers in those days were smokers. So they said, no, how can you teach us not to smoke when you're doing the same yourself? So it has to actually to come, first of all, that you're not doing sort of what the same or similar to what you're criticizing others for. That's why, like as an abbot of a monastery, I've got to lead by example. So if I'm going to teach my monks to be frugal, I have to be one of the most frugal. If I teach my monks, you know, not to to keep all those rules, then I must keep those rules, even more perfectly than my disciples. Otherwise, I've got no right to teach. So it's important, actually, you teach by example, much more than anything else. See, and it's also, you must bark at the right time and place, and not when other monks are giving talks, you dogs. See what happens? That's disagreeable, and it's also at the wrong time and place, and it's certainly unbeneficial. So, okay, but I don't think they're going to listen to me. So that's the first thing. Make sure you're doing the not doing the same thing yourself. It's also to say, make sure you're speaking with kindness, not with like anger or ill will. Because a lot of times when we speak to each other, very often it's not really thinking of somebody else about, you know, whether they need to be told this. You're just so angry that you want to tell them. You want to get it off your chest. You think, I need to say this to you. You're not really thinking of the other person. So say, don't say it out of anger. And I certainly remember when I learned this, I noticed in our monastery in Thailand many, many years ago, all the arguments in our monastery started on a certain day every week, which was the day after we'd spend all night meditating. We'd be up all night. So we used to do this in Thailand. There's one day a week, on the moon nights, we'd forego our sleep and meditate all night. And the following morning, that was when you'd have the arguments. And I noticed that. And I remember one day, I was getting angry at a couple of monks. I saw them sneak off to have a rest when I was sitting in there. You know, they were noticed. They were slackers. I knew what they were up to because I used to do the same myself. So I thought, right, I'm going to teach them a lesson. And so I wanted actually to complain about them. And some others would sneak off around the back of the monastery and brew themselves up some illicit coffee or tea, which was unallowable against the rules. I knew who they were. Ajahn Yana was one of them. I remember him, what he used to get up to. So when in the morning I thought, I'm going to really teach them a lesson. I'm going to tell them off. I'm going to tell the abbot what these guys have been up to. But then I thought, hang on, no. Because I've seen all these arguments happening on that day. But I didn't want to forget it. So I said, okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to write them down. So I wrote them on a piece of paper and say, I'm going to have my meal. And then we were allowed to go and have a sleep after our meal because we've been up all night. We could have a sleep in, you know, for a couple of hours in the middle of the day. After I had my snooze, then I would go out and tell those monks. And of course, you know what happened. As soon as you had your meal and had your snooze, I got that piece of paper. I said, oh, what am I doing this for? And it's just so petty. And I used to do the same myself when I was their age as a monk. So what's a big deal? And I screwed up that piece of paper. And I never even bothered telling anybody. Well, I learned from that. It wasn't that they were doing something wrong. That wasn't the main point. It was I was in a bad mood. I was grumpy. And that's why I was going to actually criticize somebody else. So I understand now, if you're in a bad mood, if you're grumpy, that's not the right time to actually to find fault with somebody else. It's when you really want to find fault, yeah, but it's the wrong time. Make sure that you're in a good mood. That's actually the second thing which we have to think about or contemplate before we criticize someone else. First of all, we're not doing the same ourselves. Number two, we're in a good mood. We're speaking from metta, loving kindness, not from like ill will or grumpiness. If you could just do that much, I mean, you'd have wonderful relationships in your families. And then you have these other things to make sure it's really beneficial and to make sure you put it in words which a person can accept. You don't shout at them. You don't sort of bore them out. You do it in softly. They say with words which are pleasing to the ear, which go to the heart, which are soft. So you can actually say the most disagreeable things, in a sense, if you put it in a nice way. And another thing which actually comes out, it's not in those five things, but it comes out in the sutta called the Arana Vibhanga Sutta. I was talking about this with someone on Friday night. Number two, you never criticize a person, you criticize the act. You never say, you're a stupid wife. You never said, I've never met such a dumb man before. Or you say, it's a dumb thing you did. Or is that a stupid word you said? So when you actually criticize the act and not the person, they're more liable to take it because it's not so personal. They're pointing out they've made a mistake, but it's not that they're mistakes. And you see the difference there. You can get a long way when you just focus on the fault rather than focus on the person. And then they're more liable to listen to you. Because it's not a personal criticism in the sense that there's something fundamentally wrong with them. It's just, you know, they're just some of the ways they speak, some of the ways they say things aren't always all that useful. And lastly, you have to choose the right time and place, as it says here. In other words, you don't bore somebody out in public. You don't say, sort of, Kanchana, you stupid girl, you did this and that in front of everybody, especially when it goes on the internet. So that's not a wise thing to do. So usually, you know, say, can you come over here a minute, Kanchana? And they do it sort of in private so they don't get embarrassed. Yes, John. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that particular is the five type of horses. That's actually not the Buddha training them. But he uses the simile of a horse many times. That's one of my favorite similes. But that's actually not being trained by the Buddha. That's just being trained by life. Just like sometimes when you make a mistake and do something stupid, you don't learn by it. I should have really mentioned that last Friday in my talk about punishment. Because it's actually how we learn from things. We don't need to punish when we make a mistake. We want to make a mistake, we want to understand it and learn from it. And the story is the five type of horses. There's one type of horse, when the owner, the rider, asks it to do something, it does it straight away. In other words, it's very sharp. And the second type of horse, when the owner sort of asks to do it something, it doesn't do it because it's stupid. It needs actually to see the shadow of the whip. He has to take the whip out, and when the shadow actually reaches it, he realizes, I better be behave, otherwise they'll be in trouble. It's like that's a wise person. They've learned from their mistakes in the past. And they know to say their bad speech or bad actions or silliness. And as soon as they're about to do the same again, oh, I better not do that because it's caused problems in my life before. I don't want to cause any problems in the future. The next type of person, the third type of horse, the owner, even though it tells you what to do, and even gets the whip out and the shadow falls on it, still, one is stupid enough, one still doesn't realize one is about to do something wrong. And then you just have to be tapped slightly with the whip. It doesn't hurt, just tap. Oh, that's a warning to you. You better not continue going on that path because it's going to really hurt. And that's the third type of, that's the average person. You're about to do something wrong and something tells you, no, I better not do this. And the fourth type of horse, even when the person tells it to be a good horse, even you get the whip out, the shadow falls, you tap it, you still don't understand, it has to whack it once. Ow! That hurt. But only once, and then you learn. That's why some of us, we make a mistake in life, it hurts us, but only once, that's all. And we learn our lesson when we've been hurt once. That's the fourth type of horse. And the fifth type of horse, unfortunately, is the most commonly found in the world. When you're about to do something wrong, it might be your conscience, your mind says, please don't do that. You don't listen. You get the whip out, the shadow falls on you. You still don't do anything. You touch, but you still don't understand what's going on. You get hit once. Ow! The fifth type of horse, the owner has to keep whacking it, no matter how many times it whacks it, it still doesn't understand. That's the person who keeps making the same mistake again and again and again and again in life. And still they don't understand. That's the most stupid horse. So it's not about like being trained by like a Buddha or being trained by somebody like a parent or living in a life. It's just learning from our mistakes. Sometimes that people are smart enough, they can actually see what's going to happen. They don't even need to commit the mistake. They know. But sometimes people do the mistake, but only once. And sometimes people commit the mistake again and again and again. They still don't understand what they're doing wrong. And that's really quite sad. That people say wrong things to their loved ones. And they find they get divorced, they live by themselves, they can't live with anybody. They think, why, what am I doing wrong? They still don't learn. They always think it's somebody else's fault. They've just got a cool rider. It's not a cool rider, it's a stupid horse. They still don't realize what they're doing wrong. That's why we have to have that mindfulness. We never blame anybody else. We always look, see what we're doing. And then if we hurt, must be doing something wrong. So we only hurt once, we find out why. At the most. These were just the fourth horse, but that'd be the fifth horse. Always suffering, suffering, suffering. Yeah? Agreeable, yeah, or beneficial. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of doing it. You apologize, but sometimes the lawyer's letter has already arrived. It's a bit late. Because sometimes it really depends on what you've done wrong. If it's really unbeneficial, you've really blown it, then sometimes it's a big thing which you've done. This is the problem. You've got to be very careful because speech can be very dangerous. And, speech can start wars. Not just in a family, but in big communities. And, we're a community here, our Buddhist society. And sometimes in our committee meetings, we have to make sure that people are kind to each other. Otherwise, what's the point of having a Buddhist society? I always make the point, we're a Buddhist society before we're a society. The Buddhist comes first, that's the first word in our Buddhist society of WA. Buddhist is number one. So I was talking to someone last night. I went to a little house blessing last night for this fellow, and he was talking to me about he's helping out some other Buddhist societies in Perth, and they've had a lot of conflict. And I was saying, well, they can't really call themselves Buddhist societies, because even in our cabinet, the governor of Western Australia, the minister for the Minister for Infrastructure and Planning, Alana McTiernan, told me that whenever the cabinet starts to get angry and there's an argument brewing there, the Premier, Jeff Gallop, stands up and said, "Be quiet, we should all be more Buddhist about this." So he said that he's very close to being a Buddhist, Jeff Gallop. So he was saying that if that's what happens in the cabinet, and that's like a big committee, and of a sort of a powerful state with no huge budget, if they can actually do that, surely little Buddhist committees can do that. So being Buddhist means actually we restrain ourselves. We don't get angry. So if we're getting angry, we just stop, walk away. So we never actually criticize someone. If those five things we're supposed to think about before we actually open our mouth, make sure we're not speaking out of anger. We're speaking out of real loving kindness, not because we're grumpy. And it is really beneficial. The right time, the right place. And sometimes the right thing to do is to be quiet. Even if it's disagreeable. Sometimes it's okay to say it's the right time and the right place. Because sometimes just going to Malaysia and Singapore, many of the Malaysians in Singapore are being oppressed by some of the worst type of Christianity, the charismatic evangelical Christianity. And sometimes they were saying, the Christians were saying all these things that Jesus was a prophet, that Buddha wasn't a prophet, he was nobody. And so you should actually worship our Jesus because Buddha wasn't a god, he wasn't the son of a god, he's a nobody, he's an ordinary bloke. And I said, what if it's the right time? And as if it's beneficial. I know it's disagreeable to the Christians, but you can actually tell them our Buddha was the teacher of your God. Because it says so in the text, the teacher of gods and men. But I said, make sure it's the right time and place, you can get into big trouble. If there's more of them than there are of you. Or I was telling them that sometimes in Singapore, Malaysia, saying, the Buddha died a long time ago, but Jesus is still alive. What do you mean the Buddha died a long time ago? Because it says in the suttas, one of the favorite quotes, this was said to Wakali in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Say, he who sees, or the one who sees the Buddha, sees the Dhamma. He who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. It's a very famous quote. So, can you still see the Dhamma today? Is the Dhamma still alive? Yeah, so if the Dhamma still alive, the Buddha is still alive. So I want to get these new, it makes sense, very easy logic, I want to get all these car stickers. The Buddha lives. But as long as that's the right time and the right place. Otherwise you get your car windscreen smashed. Okay, just being cheeky. Yes. Okay. Oh, there we go again. Yeah. Don't waste time. Okay, this is a good idea. If it's going to be beneficial, then you say something. If it's unbeneficial, as the Buddha says here, be quiet. Yeah, it should have been here at the beginning of the talk. Yeah. 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 Well, it depends actually who they are. If they're much bigger than me, that's what my sometimes I say. The right time, whatever's beneficial, because what we're actually saying here is that in the Buddha says, knows actually how to speak. Prince, such speech as the target knows to be untrue, incorrect, and unbeneficial, which is also unwelcome, disagreeable to others. He doesn't say. Speech which is true, correct, but unbeneficial and unwelcome, doesn't say. Speech which is true, correct, and beneficial, which is unwelcome and disagreeable, you know the right time and place to say that. So sometimes if it's true and beneficial, you get the right time and place, okay, go for it. So it really depends upon time and place, especially. So there is a time actually to be assertive. And to say, no, sir, I disagree with you, I think you're wrong. But it has to be true, beneficial, out of kindness, and also has to be done at the right time and the right place. I know when I was a young monk here, I think when we were in Magnolia Street, the first year I was here, we got this letter drop from the Potter's House. And they had this, I'm not sure, this documentary, and they had all these things being exposed, like iridology exposed, homeopathy exposed, vegetarianism exposed. and also Buddhism exposed. It was all crazy stuff. I don't know what's wrong with iridology or vegetarianism, but it was all, you know, supposed to be exposed. So I asked Ajahn Chah, can I go there and sort of argue with these people? He said, ah, yeah, sure, you go. So I was ready to go, and Ninian said, no, you better not. There's more of them than of you, you might get into trouble. And it was true. You know, I was ready to go, but it was the wrong time, the wrong place. So you shouldn't do that. Yeah. Oh, that's right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, absolutely, I agree with that. Ah, yes, it has to be beneficial to both. When you weigh up the results of what you're about to say, is it going to be beneficial to both? Sometimes it will be beneficial to one, but not to the other. But if it's more benefit than unbenefit, they'd go for it. Yes. The other thing, I think I mentioned those in passing, is one has to make sure that one is doing the same, not doing the same thing, that one is not acting out of ill will or anger. It has to be true and correct. I think it has to be said kindly. And what's the fifth one? Is, I think it's the beneficial one. No, time and place. Time and place. Those are the five things you have to think about before you admonish someone as a monk. So a lot of time you don't actually need to admonish, because most people, if they made a mistake, like you, if you made a mistake, you know you've made a mistake. Sometimes you don't need to be told off by somebody else. You know, you realise that, oh, I shouldn't have said that. So the other person doesn't need to say, oh, you shouldn't have said that, because you know that already. And sometimes it doesn't really help the situation. So a lot of times it's best to keep quiet. Okay, so I managed to fill the hour and 15 minutes by a few stories. So we conclude here. When this was said, Prince Abhaya said, magnificent Venerable Sir, magnificent Venerable Sir, the Blessed One has made the Dharma clear in many ways. From today, let the Blessed One remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So he was no longer a Jain, now he was a Buddhist. Because he learned, tried to bamboozle or trick the Buddha with a double-edged question, and the Buddha said sometimes that there aren't sort of straight answer to that question. You've got to really think quite clearly. I remember some time ago, Ajahn Jacquero asked me that old philosophical question. What was it about? I was about lying. That's right, there was two guards, one always lied, the other one always told the truth. And you had to ask the other one. Okay, you have to ask the one. No, what was it? That do all Spartans lie or something? I forgot how that worked. Anyway, I better stop before I'm ahead because I'm getting confused. And I think what I'm about to say is unbeneficial. So it's a nice to ask you to shut up. I know the right time and place. I've forgotten that story. Okay, so thank you for listening today to the Prince Abhaya Sutta. And it's a touchy-feely one about putting something out of your throat, about speaking. It's not high dumb about the nature of the mind or deep jhanas, but it just shows the range of teachings which you have in the Buddha Suttas. So hopefully you enjoyed that. Now we'll just do the what do you do now? You do the, yeah? And this is, okay, you've got a request for next time. Who's the first one? Well, this is your touchy-feely one today, so it has to be John's one. Go on. 33, which is, what's that? It's a long one. 33 is the, what is it? I don't know that one. Yeah, I was getting Mahagopalika, the greater discourse on the cowherd. Okay. Okay. You get some nice, interesting sutras. The discourse on the, we call it the cowboy. The cowboy discourse. The greater discourse on the cowboy. Number 33. Okay. And to let you know, that will be on the, was it the 30th of, that's right. Because on the 23rd, which is should be the next sutta class, we're having the at 3 o'clock we're having an auction. Before then, at 10 a.m. we're having a fundraiser for the tsunami victims here, food fair and all sorts of stuff going on. The Sri Lankan Society are having their food fair on the Saturday at Fremantle, so we're working with them. We're going to have a food fair here on Sunday, and it will culminate with an auction at 3 o'clock and a barbershop quartet to entertain us as we're doing the auction. I'm going to auction off a Buddha statue I've had in my heart for a long time. It's been super blessed. I mean, really super, super blessed. So that should be worth a fortune. And somebody suggested yesterday, I have my meditation cushion, which I've been sitting on that for, I don't know how many years, my orange one, must be over 10, 12, 13 years now. I've had some great meditations. That too is super powered. So those of you who want to get a quick advance in your meditation, you're going to auction off my meditation cushion as well. And be on 3 p.m. I did this in Singapore. There was one. I was only doing a teaching retreat there for 7 days, and the cushion I was sitting on for those 6 or 7 days, they auctioned that. They got $1,700 for that. And they sent it to the our monastery in Victoria. So this one should be worth much more than that. And it's all for the tsunami victims. So that's the auction of my meditation cushion and a few other little bits and pieces at 3 o'clock. So we're going to have, and what I'm going to do for next weekend, they're going to be on display, and I'm going to leave some envelopes there so people who can't come there for the day, they can put their bids in sealed envelopes. And on the day that when we get to the highest bid, and I'll open up the envelopes and that bid is higher, then you get that cushion. So, they say enlightenment is priceless. I mean, you have to sort of work so hard to meditate year after year after year, and now you can get sort of a boost with my meditation cushion. So hopefully that will raise some funds for tsunami victims. So there'll be a few more things going on. So there'll be no sutta class in 2 weeks. We're going to hold it on the fifth Sunday, which will be the 29th. Okay, so the 29th will be sutta number 33. Okay? Okay, so thanks for coming. Let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhe Suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Suppatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho sanghaṃ namāmi